Good morning and welcome to another edition of Community Matters. My name is James Gage and I am privileged to be here this morning with Ivan Castro, who's the research coordinator at the VA, who's going to talk to us a little bit about lead exposure and what that means for you and for your kids. Good morning. How are you doing, Ivan?
Good morning, James. I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Now, what I want to ask you first is how did this become a subject of interest to you, lead exposure?
So I just graduated from a master's program at Syracuse University, and while in the program, I was involved in a bigger NIH study concerning lead. So as part of my program, I had to write a thesis, and I decided to focus on blood lead levels for children. We already had a sample that we were working on, so it seemed like a good fit to keep working on that.
Is that something that you heard about before? Is it a subject that was close to you before, or you just found it and started doing some research?
Yes. So I knew about it before. Especially I have a little boy. When you have a kid, you start learning about all these other things that were never a thought.
Absolutely.
And then you start learning about it, but I never knew all the details or the levels of what lead does or what exposure means or why not. And I have been working with my advisor a few years before that on a separate project, and the way he speaks about lead is like he just knows it. And it just inspired me to be like, okay, well, what can I do with this?
How can I
improve on something?
So lead exposure, usually when people talk about lead, you're already talking about lead poisoning. What's the difference between lead exposure and lead poisoning?
So lead poisoning is somewhat rare nowadays, but lead poisoning is just a systemic sequence of lead toxicity, right? And lead toxicity happens when you're exposed to high levels of lead. And by high, I mean like 20, 30 micrograms in your blood. And that's what was happening before in the 70s when kids would eat paint chips and they would just get too much lead in their body, right?
Right, sure.
Or there was lead in gasoline. So those kind of levels we don't see anymore. But people can say, oh, this child has lead poisoning when their levels are above 5 micrograms per deciliter.
I laughed when you mentioned lead paint, eating paint chips, because that's one of those insults that my sisters always hurled at me. You must have eaten lead paint chips when you were a kid.
Yeah. It's somewhat funny, right? But it comes from a certain just time where we didn't know any better. No, the officials didn't know any better, and then there was just lead everywhere.
So lead in gasoline, how long has it been since lead has been banned in gasoline?
It got banned, I want to say, in the early 90s, 1990, 1991.
So there was a significant period of time where lead was coming out of emissions in cars, it's been put on houses through paint, and I'm sure in other ways. A pretty significant period of time where all of lead is just being introduced to the environment.
Yes, right. And so then when we talk about lead exposure, I focus on children, but it could be anyone exposed to lead in the environment. Right? We can't control it. We don't see it. You're just exposed to it. So with gasoline, yeah, all the emissions would just go out in the air, and then the lead would just kind of settle on the sediments and the soils. And that has changed for the past like 20, 25 years since it got banned. But we still find that there are some disparities in lead exposure. So one of the risk factors for lead exposure is not only living in an old home, but also just individual socioeconomic status.
So those are the biggest sources of lead exposure today in 2019, living in an older home?
Yes. And the housing stock in most of these towns in New York is pretty old.
Right.
And there's state regulations, right, that the landlord has to repair any lead hazards. But at the same time, there's like a quick getaway where the landlord can just say, I do not know of any lead hazards. And then they just check that off, and then that's it. So they don't really have to go and inspect the house before they rent it or before they sell it.
So if you're living in a home, renting a home or renting an apartment, your landlord might not have ever done a lead test, just simply said on a form, I'm not aware of any lead that exists.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So how could a person go about finding out if there is lead in their home?
Well, I believe it varies by county, but usually county health departments will have some kind of abatement program. Usually what happens, our system is very reactive. So like all children under two are mandated to get blood lead testing at their pediatricians. They'll get the blood level, and then it's not an actual level. It's just like, oh, this level is above 3 micrograms per deciliter or below. And if it's above 3 micrograms per deciliter, they'll do an actual IV blood draw
Wow.
to measure the the actual levels. And then once that gets flagged as an elevated blood lead level, at least in Onondaga County, the county will target that family or that child. They'll inspect the home.
And it's probably something similar in Madison or Oneida counties.
I would believe so. Like I said, it varies a little bit by county and by city. Some cities have their own programs. Most don't. So it's at the county level.
Right.
But the one thing they have in common is it's a reactive system and not a preventive system.
Sure. So you have to be proactive and find out if it's there, if it exists.
Yes. And it's not an easy thing to do because there could be like insurance costs that there won't be covered or why not. So when I say it's a reactive system, I mean like the health department doesn't know about a child or they don't look out for high risk locations as far as I know. But once a high blood lead level sample comes back, then they go to the home and they inspect it. And I think there's a lot of preconceived notions about who may have lead exposure. So sometimes as a child, this is a somewhat higher middle income family. They may say, oh, this child is fine. Right. And that's not the case.
Because lead exposure, stereotypically, you think, well, the lead is probably in areas of the town where there's lower income, where houses are more run down. But if you find lead exposure in a child or a middle socioeconomic class, people might assume it's okay, that everything's fine.
Yeah, it may just be, right? So like a lot of the public health and epidemiology goes on like risk factors and like, oh, well, these children don't meet these risk factors. And it just kind of goes by the wayside. So another thing is just how it gets into the environment. So maybe you have a family, you're middle income, you're repairing your home, right? But let's say this home was built in 1968. And it's not run down by any means, but if you're abating, you know, you're remodeling a bathroom or something and you're scraping all that paint off the wall, if it was built before 1970, it's very likely that it's lead-based painting and it has to be controlled. That's another thing that people don't think about. They'll just abate or remodel something without controlling where that dust goes, and then a child can be exposed within that event happening.
Sure. What can a person do who's maybe doing an abatement or a remodel and wants to control the dusts in the air from the lead paint? What is something that you can do?
Well, and that's a tough question, right? I'm not very handy per se, right? But I think if you're doing it yourself, you tend to just do it and get it done. If you get a professional, you can request that they maybe tarp off a certain room, that they have ventilation, that they collect the dust or like filter out a certain way, as opposed to just remodeling a bathroom and then the dust just goes throughout the house and you don't know where it settles.
But that sounds like something that your average weekend warrior working on their own home could do, is tarp off doorways, vacuum out whenever it has settled in the room where you're doing work. Probably, I would assume, wearing a mask of some kind of
yes,
respiratory device to make sure you're not breathing it yourself.
Definitely. But that's something that most people won't think about, right? Because it's just like an afterthought. No one says, oh, I need to worry about any lead-based paintings in this old paint job. It's just unfortunate if there happens to be children in the home and then they happen to be exposed.
Sure.
And it's not that every child will get exposed. There's a lot of nature versus nurture. A child could be exposed to lead one time and you may not even know it, and then it's fine, right? Because in the grand scheme of that child's life, you know, there's other protective factors as opposed to just risk factors.
Right, sure.
But when we talk about lead exposure, let's say in impoverished neighborhoods, and there's just a constant exposure, right? So it could be low-level lead from an old home. So your home's old and then paint is chipping somewhere. And then maybe the child's exposed to it once, right? Very low levels. But then if that's a repeated exposure, those levels will never go down. So what we know about lead in the blood is like it'll circulate in your blood system for about 30, 45 days. And then it'll just start settling in your bones.
Hmm.
And then that won't become an issue until you're older again and your bone starts decaying. And then all that lead residue that's on the bone starts flowing through your blood system again.
So this isn't just something that once it's in your system, your body will eventually reject and will come out as waste. Mm-hmm. This is something that once it's in the blood, it's there and it settles into the bones.
Yeah, especially if it's just a repeated exposure. Because, I mean, some of it may just go out through like your body fluids, but most of it will get settled in the blood. A lot of that has to interact with like what kind of diet you have and what kind of health habits you have.
Sure.
For example, a child could be exposed to lead. You may not know it. he may have lead in their blood, and maybe that child drinks a lot of soda, right? So soda, it fights with calcium in your body. When you drink a lot of soda, it tends to win, and your body doesn't absorb any calcium you're consuming. And when you have low calcium, it's easier for lead to just
to get
go
into the
down
bones.
Into the bones.
Yeah, wow. That's interesting.
So it's just like, if you think about it, it's a network of possible roads that could lead to any one outcome.
And everything working together for the worst, really. So you mentioned earlier about blood levels. I would imagine that the CDC or the government has certain criteria for what's a safe level in the blood and what's not. Is that the case?
Yes and no. So the CDC has a standard, which is 5 micrograms per deciliter. And that's a metric of concern. It's been found that there are no safe levels of blood, right? That's a misconception that people would say, oh, he's under 5, he's safe. And that's not true. A lot of the research that I'm involved in just deals with low-level lead. And we find that even at low level, you know, like 1.5 micrograms per deciliter, we can still see differences in hostility outcomes or emotion regulation in children. And that's because the lead itself, it's consequential no matter at what level. You know, what the CDC has established is just a level of concern where at that level, it's mandated that someone takes action, usually the county health department.
Sure.
Right? Back in the 90s, that was 10 micrograms per deciliter. Before that,
wow.
It was 25.
Oh, wow.
Right? So it's like all these regulations have been put in place, but as the research furthers the findings, then we're just finding more and more that there's just no safe level.
So 5 is the magic number for where there's government intervention, but anything before that is still any level at all of lead in the blood is consequential, like you said, is significant and could be harmful.
And honestly, 5 is really just if we talk about percentiles, that 5 micrograms per deciliter is just the top 95th percentile of children, and this was set up in 2005, I believe, or 2010. So they did national nutritional surveys, and they found that most children will have lead levels between 0 and 5. And then 5 and up, that's that 5th percentile that they have extreme levels. And that has changed. I think there was a new national survey, and that was lowered to 3, but officially the CDC hasn't adopted that metric, not yet. There was a plan to update that metric every 3 years, every 4 years when they do the surveys. But they haven't, and I don't know if that's a federal regulation or any bureaucracy. Like I couldn't tell you, but that hasn't changed.
Well, I would imagine it costs money to intervene, and so at some point there has to be some level of regulation where the government does step in and make some kind of effort.
Yeah, and it's a trade-off, right? So that's a debate right now. So like right now, we can talk about how many children are missed because they may have like 4 micrograms per deciliter in the blood,
right?
But then if we lower that, let's say we lower that to 2, how many resources do we have to take care of everyone and not forget about those children that have high levels,
right,
above 5, you know, because now you include a big cohort of new children that are under the area of concern. So it has to do with money and resources.
Absolutely. And really, it seems like the best way then to prevent exposure is to be proactive yourself and not wait until it's at a certain level where there's intervention from the government, but rather to be proactive yourself. So you mentioned paint in homes. Are there other risk factors that increase the level of lead exposure that a child has?
Yes, and this is the actual research that I did, and it's we found that the spatial density of vacant homes, right, old vacant homes built before 1970, does affect blood lead levels. So we did the study in Syracuse. We had for the sample, we had about 220 children with measured blood lead, and we had information on socioeconomic status. We had information on the age of their housing and street address. So it's somewhat kind of technical, but you figure out what the density of vacant homes is, right? And we got that information because it's publicly available.
And by density of vacant homes, you mean how many vacant homes are in a given area?
Yes, but it's more intricate than that. So we didn't want to just say the zip code level because that's too wide, or at the track level. So we measure a map of all the empty homes, you know, as of August 2017. That's the data we downloaded. And what the program does is, like, it captures every empty home, and then we use the window of 240 meters, and it just counts. It goes, the window goes from home to home to home, and it starts counting how many vacant houses are within each window, and then it just adds them all up into a layer. And we found that those areas where those windows overlap the most had an increase in blood lead levels compared to other areas where it was a lower density. And that was after accounting for gender, age, race, individual family, SES, and the age of housing.
So being in an area where there's a higher density of vacant homes is a bigger risk factor.
No, I wouldn't say it's a bigger risk factor, but it definitely contributes. So it's still the biggest source of lead exposure in children is their home.
It's their own home.
Yeah, so it's just about the age of the housing and whether the house is somewhat maintained or not maintained or whatnot. It's just most exposure that happens nowadays happens at the home. And it's right, so any houses built before 1970 are very likely to have lead-based paints. And then that likelihood increases, you know, if it's built before 1940 or before 1900. We found some of these empty houses, or even houses that people are living now, were built in the late 1800s. So that these are really, some of these housing stock is very old, and is very likely to have lead-based painting.
Sure.
Right? Because you can repaint the wall, all the previous layers are still there.
Are still there, right, sure.
You know, I mean, they could like fully scrape everything off, but you don't know if that's happened. So
is there something that you can paint over rather than scraping all the lead paint off? Is there something you can put over an existing coat of paint that reduces the lead exposure?
Not that I've heard of a special paint, but like that's the easiest way. If paint's chipping, just paint over it, right? Because it will cover it. The problem is when it starts peeling and then just keeps peeling, you know, anything that's behind it, in the old layers, it would just chip away. And, you know, so with little children, like you mentioned with the joke, like little children will put it in their mouth. And it's sweet. Right. I've never tasted it, but the research says that the lead, you know, in paint, it tastes very sweet. And that's why there was a big problem with lead poisoning back then, because they were just eating it.
They'd find it and put it in their mouths. And children will put anything in their mouth.
Yes. So a fresh coat of paint may not solve it, but may be a quick, easy fix if you think that you may have lead. You can always do, I think you can pay for lead testing. I'm not sure how much that would be or who to call. I think if you're concerned, you could call your county health department, and depending on the health department, they may do it for free, or it may be needs-based. That'll be a local department question.
So that was my next question. If I own, I'm a homeowner, I can always look at my deed and see when my home was built and make a determination from there if the paint is old enough or hasn't been removed since the 1970s, and make a determination if it needs to be fixed or removed and safely.
Right.
But if you're renting a home, you might not have that information available to you. When your home was built, and if renovations have been made to make it more safe from lead exposure. So you're saying that if you have a concern, you can always call a county.
Every county health department in New York should have a lead abatement program or a lead hazard program, and that's, you know, that's their main goal, is to abate or reduce lead exposure. And yeah, they can call. And like you mentioned, with the home or an apartment you're renting, that information should be available. I mean, it should be documented somewhere when that housing was built. And most people know. I mean, you can see a building. It's like, oh, that building's been here since my grandpa was around. So, you
right.
know, it's older than 1970. But you don't know if it's ever been abated or if there's lead hazards in it or why not. Because like I said, most landlords just tend to check that I'm not aware of any lead hazards in this property. And that's it. So
you could approach your landlord and say, hey, what's been done to reduce the level of lead exposure in this home? And they could be honest with you, but they might not be.
Yeah. I mean, what are the odds of that?
Right.
It's a hazard for the landlord, too. I think there was a program I can't remember if it was in Oswego or Syracuse or maybe somewhere in Madison County, but like a local government got together and said, you know, they pleaded out to the local landlords to invest and just get their lead hazard checks done. And they would like give them some kind of tax exempt or just some tax benefit or whatnot. But no one signed up.
Really?
Right. So they reached out to so many landlords and no one signed up. Right. Because at the end of the day, you know, like it's human nature. We're going to choose whatever is most beneficial for us. And we may not even consider, well, you know, I'm renting that place.
Right.
I'm renting it, you know.
So really the best thing is to be proactive for yourself and not just assume.
Yeah. Or be proactive from a state level, you know, like you can change the regulations and it won't be popular, right? Like we don't know. We talk about individual responsibility or whatnot, but can the state say, you know what, we're going to mandate that every housing unit that's rented or sold has an approved lead test? Is that necessary? You know, would that be approved? You know, there's so many questions. Once it gets to a political level of like management or information, like I don't know. Like that's where my extent reaches because I don't understand politics that well to say, you know, it's easy for me to say, well, you know what, this is a health issue. We can take care of it, but sure. I don't understand the economic side of it or the political side of it.
But based on the research that you've done, would you say that there needs to be more intervention, that there could be more intervention or more legislation passed that looks into this issue?
There could be more intervention, you know, but it comes back to time and money. In New Orleans had old housing stock. And when Katrina came through, right, it destroyed a lot of housing, and it raised the lead levels in the environment, in soil and water around New Orleans. But New Orleans had to get rebuilt. They either rebuilt areas of the town,
sure,
or they completely gutted these buildings and housing and repainted and everything. And lead levels, you know, in public housing in New Orleans have dropped, right? So like public housing used to have high levels or high numbers of children with elevated lead levels, and that number has dropped significantly since Katrina. Just the lead level in the soil around New Orleans is lower now than it was before Katrina. And it's not like we don't want to say we want a hurricane to come through here.
Right, right? Sure.
But New Orleans was pretty much rebuilt.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to say, you know what, we expect the state to rebuild all our towns. It's just, it's impossible.
Of course.
But that would be the utopian solution. You know, either you rebuild everything fresh, or anything that's old, just get rid of it in a controlled manner. But, you know, that's just wishful thinking.
To me, it seems like lead exposure is the new asbestos exposure. People went to great lengths to remove asbestos from homes because they found that it was contributing greatly to lung cancer.
Yes.
But the data was pretty conclusive. And it sounds like when it comes to lead exposure or lead poisoning, when it gets to that level, it's not as black and white. It doesn't seem like an issue that most people would consider to be an open and shut case.
Yeah. Most people won't even think about it until a blood test comes back for your young child that says, oh, you have high levels of lead. And then after that, I mean, I don't know what the average person does. They do something or they forget about it, why not? And it's not to scare everyone, right? So like, I think we've done great improvements in this, right? It's just, there's still more that could be done.
Sure.
But the levels that we have now are relatively low compared to what we were seeing just even in the 90s.
Sure.
You know, so there's been a huge improvement in levels of exposure. There's been a huge improvement in lowering the number of children nationwide that have high levels and just kind of mitigating these outcomes. There's been tons of research and legislation that has helped. So it's not something that we want to put fear in people. It's just something that is still a concern and people just should be more aware.
Sure, absolutely. Now, you mentioned that levels in the blood, it ends up in the bones. That can be big problems. You mentioned, too, that high levels of lead in the blood can contribute to emotional and behavioral issues. What other signs or can you elaborate on what kind of signs you might notice in a child who has been exposed to lead in the blood?
Well, I wouldn't say there's signs. It's kind of hard to – there's no signs of lead exposure. We just know that the lead has an impact on these outcomes, right? Because a child could have emotional dysregulation just because that's just the nature of that child, or maybe because that child has some other neurological disorder and not just SLED. So there's no way to say, oh, that person has been exposed to SLED. So there's no signs. But there's definitely a multitude of outcomes just from like just so emotion and hostility behaviors, learning, like cognitive deficiencies. We know that children that have been exposed to not just higher levels of lead, but just constant exposure of lead have lower cognitive abilities, you know, in educational settings. There's also cardiovascular disease. So we know that lead, you know, it's a heavy metal, and when it's flowing through your blood, it affects your cardiovascular disease. And this is not something that a child would develop, right? No one develops cardiovascular disease, or I shouldn't say no one, but normally you wouldn't develop cardiovascular disease until you're an adult.
Right.
But if you, as a child, let's say, you know, from age 3 to age 12, you live somewhere and you were constantly being exposed to lead, even at low levels, all that lead has been in your system for about a decade. And we know that right now we can test for certain just subclinical markers of developing cardiovascular disease that are predicted by lead levels. You know, so like when you talk about cardiovascular disease, you can look at aortic pressure or the left ventricular mass index, right, which is just the mass of your heart based on your height and weight. So it's like all these like calculations that have been identified as markers for developing cardiovascular disease. And now we are finding that lead levels in childhood affect the subclinical markers that will affect a disease outcome later in life.
Wow.
So it's a pretty intricate relationship.
Yeah, sure.
So,
well, Ivan, we really appreciate you talking to us today about this serious issue. I think people can take it more seriously and think more about it. We certainly appreciate the education on it. So I appreciate the talk about this and the research that you've done.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Is there anything else you'd want us to know before we head out?
Not necessarily to know. I do want to point out, I think we need to just get away from this stereotypical risk factors of race or poverty or age of housing. I think poverty is a big source of disparities in health outcomes, but it's not because of poverty itself or because of race itself, but it's because of the available resource that we have due to our membership into a specific socioeconomic status. So I think we can do more just by attacking concrete influences in exposure as opposed to just saying, you know what, we can't give everyone $1,000 a week,
right,
so we can't help them at all. But you can do other stuff. You know, as a population, we can do other stuff together because we can still have different socioeconomic status and we can all be healthy.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here, and we look forward to hearing from you again sometime.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.